this comes like
that. To let this up. So let me say a little, do a...
Name and title.
Couple of phrases. This is on God language, gender, and prayer. And I'm going to talk particularly about the image of God as Abba, which I will construe the meaning of as we go through this talk. Let me just quickly recapitulate for those of you who haven't weren't in the group yesterday, some of the points I developed about renewed God language. First of all, that God language is metaphorical by nature. None of us have seen God. And so all of our images about God are drawn from images of experiences with created things and persons and so on, which we then metaphorically apply to God. And so one has to be clear about all of our language for God as metaphorical. That is to say, we should always say that God is like this, but also not literally this. Then secondly, in terms of gender images, that God is, of course, beyond literal gender, neither male nor female, but imageable in both male and female genders. And one needs to be serious about that if you are serious about both men and women being in the image of God. I suggested that we need a plurality of concrete images drawn from real experiences that really touch our feelings, our emotions at a deep level. In other words, that prayer language is more like poetry language than it is like science language. And that it's much more prayer-like and also much more appropriate to biblical language to move into a plurality of metaphors drawn from both male and female experience and also from nature, then to move towards some kind of one quote-unquote master symbol that tends to be abstract and neutral. And I said that because I think one of the dominant tendencies in doing so-called inclusive God language is to move towards some kind of so-called neutral generics, although often there is still hiding under such generics a presupposition that the male is the normative person. So I think one needs sort of explicit female as well as male imagery rather than going the abstract neutral route. And then finally, that one needs language for God that overcomes rather than reinforces stereotypic masculinity and femininity patterns. In other words, if you're going to talk about God in terms of both genders, try to overcome language that just reinforces that maleness equals masculinity, force, dominance, violence, wrath, and femininity equals passivity, nurture, and so on. That one needs to attempt to go beyond those stereotypic dualisms, which I think have very much truncated our humanity as both male and female, and also go beyond power relationships of domination and servility in favor of power relationships which are empowering, in which God as power is a power that liberates and brings us in to our potential rather than a power that represses and reduces us. And again, I think a lot of our God language has been drawn after dominating power rather than liberating power. So those are the kind of basic things I developed. And I want to concentrate today on that image of God, which has tended to become the dominant image for God in Christianity. And I would suggest particularly in what I would call bourgeois Christianity, Christianity since the 17th century, which has tended increasingly to privatize religion and then focus on the family as the primary locus of religion, that the Father has, it's really in that context that God as Father has come to be seen as so normative that some theologians can confidently exclaim that this is in fact God's name. God's name is Father. I think it was, in fact, a Lutheran theologian insisted that this was God's revealed name, was Father, and so you couldn't in any way supplement that. There are several questions that I want to raise about that notion of God as Father, as the normative name. And using God as Father as almost the exclusive image. First of all, certainly there's a problem of presenting God as so normatively male as to really think God is male, or that female imagery is really excluded by the very nature of God. But I think there's more than just the question of maleness here. For me, a very key element is that what is really hiding here is not simply maleness, but a certain construction of fatherhood. Namely, fatherhood as pater familias. Those of you, any of you here from my first session, some of you, I talked about the pater familias in Roman law as being construed after really a master sovereignty relationship to the family, so that in Roman law, the familia, the father was not even seen as a member of the familia. The familia was his property, those he ruled over, so that the familia was defined as wife, dependent children, slaves or servants, property, and animals. But the father was seen as sovereign over, ruler over. And that pattern certainly is used at certain points, like the household codes, where there's an effort to reestablish that relationship in language of children obey your parents, wives obey your husbands, slaves obey your masters, which is, you know, all three of these dependent classes of people are thought of as in relationship to a paterfamilias, who, of course, is one person. That was the husband, father, and master are the same guy, so to speak. So what I'm suggesting here is the problem is not simply that the word, thinking of God exclusively by a male name, but rather a male name that suggests a particular kind of relation, kind of fatherhood, namely the paterfamilias fatherhood. Let me say a little bit about the so-called biblical roots of the name of God as Father. Mary's already been doing a lot of this. As I said, it has been insisted by some that one has to, as a Christian, use the name Father for God. That this is virtually God's revealed name, not just a metaphor. As far as I know, in Hebrew scripture, there's only one place which suggests that there is a kind of a revealed name of God, and that's in the burning bush. And the name given for God is I am who I am, or I am who I will be in some translations, which, needless to say, is a rather mysterious and not at all patriarchal name. And I think suggests the sense that God is a being that cannot be contained and limited by human names, images, pictures, and so on. There's lots of other images for God, and I would say the Hebrew scripture is characterized by a multiplicity of metaphors, often drawn from male social roles, but not only that, also there are female imagery, and there's a variety of nature imagery for God. And so when one points that out, then the typical argument focuses on Jesus. Well, it's Jesus who said God is Father, and therefore we must use that as Christians, as the exclusive name. And particularly, I think that notion that God is Father gets linked up with the whole Trinitarian theology. That Jesus is Son of the Father, and so this relationship of Jesus as Son to the Father sort of establishes that as somehow the normative notion of God for Christians. I would suggest that concept belongs more to, or gets rigid more in later Christian Trinitarian theology than it actually is in the New Testament. So let me just say a few things about what I see as New Testament, and particularly images that come from the Gospels. There are some people around who are disputing the notion that Jesus sort of uniquely used the word Abba for God, but I will sort of assume that that is a, an important name for God in the Gospels, and that we'll just for the moment assume that, that Jesus is the primary innovator of that name. But it has been, I'm sure you've heard this before, but I'd like to expand a little bit, that the name Abba is in many ways a strikingly innovative name. Most particularly, it is not a paterfamilias, father. It is indeed a name for father, but it is a name for, it is precisely the child's name for God. It might be translated something like Dada. And therefore, it establishes a relationship to God that we might stereotypically think is more a relationship to a mother. Or if you want to put it, I think, more positively, that it's precisely a fatherhood, which is a nurturing fatherhood. Establishing a relationship of trust, of the kind that one has toward a figure in whom one has a kind of unconditional assurance of relationship. In other words, not the authoritarian father who's going to sort of disinherit you if you aren't good. The word Abba, however, has a broader meaning than our word Dada is not something that you would normally call other adults other than your, you know, one adult would usually not call another adult Dada in our society. But in Jesus' society, there was another relationship besides the child's relationship to a trusted, loving father, by which you would use the word Abba, and that is the relationship to a holy man who is a guru. And that's, of course, the use of that term quickly became the word for the Christian holy man, and the trusting, loving relationship of the disciples of a holy man for their guru, and therefore the word Abba, which we translates in English as abbot, became a word for that holy man. And so the relationship, so it had some multiple layerings to it, and a similar term is a term that might give us some of that double meaning is found in Hindi in the word Babu. Now, if any of you saw the film on Gandhi, where the word Babu, and the word Babu in Hindu means grandfather. And it's a trusting, loving relationship of a little child to a grandfather. But it's also, again, the word for a holy man, not in the sense of someone that you fear, but an affectionate name that you, when you call a man Babu, you both say that you are his disciple, that he is the one who really is the nurturer of your soul, but it is an affectionate term. And so Gandhi was called in that way, Babu. So we might think of those layerings of meaning, which I think made this have a particular kind of resonance. I suggest that Jesus uses takes the word Abba, or whatever early Christianity gave us this name, to establish a relationship to God as one of trust rather than domination. But also, I would say paradoxically, he uses it to forbid relationships of domination between Christians. And that comes out very explicitly in the language in Matthew 23, where you have that whole passage where Jesus says, because you have one Abba, Father in heaven, you should call no man father. And then it goes on, because you have one master in heaven, you should call no man master, call no man teacher, and so on. So this seems to me to be a kind of parallel to the Hebrew tradition that because God is king, we no longer have allegiance to human kings. That the relationship to God frees us from allegiance to human authorities, and therefore it sort of breaks the stereotypic use of language for God, which is then used to duplicate hierarchical relationships between people. I've preached on a number of occasions on this passage, Call No Man Father, and I always find it interesting. The response is, in one Methodist church where I preached, I said, you know, we have to think about that in terms of language of ministry as reverend and so on. And somebody told me later that the pastor went out afterwards and he removed all the revs from the front of the sign. In any case, I think something's going on here by which the relationship to God as Abba is intended not to create hierarchy among Christians, but precisely to dispel it, to create a relationship to God that at the same time creates relationships of mutual service between Christians. And I think this correlates with a lot of other aspects of the language that Jesus uses in the Gospels, the language about the Christ coming not as a king but as a servant. This then becomes the model of Christian relationship to each other. The greatest of you shall be a servant. Servanthood is not prescribed for people who are already in servility, but rather it's prescribed precisely for those who would be leaders, that they have to use their role in a relationship of service rather than of domination. And there's one could quote a number of passages where that there's this effort, to kind of transform the sense of what power relationships mean into service rather than domination. So I think both of those things are there in the Abba language. It's both the language of establishing a relationship to God as one of trusting love rather than domination, and then at the same time to forbid relationship of domination between Christians too, and to prescribe power relationships that are serving rather than dominating. However, I think we have to recognize that although Abba is a very important key to relationship to God, that there's a lot of other imagery floating around in the Gospels. And I'll just mention two aspects which I find are important. There's a certain group of parables. And if we know anything about Jesus, it would seem to be that he taught in parables. There's a certain group of parables which very consciously uses parallel images for men and women to image God or perhaps in some cases Christ. And these are what's sometimes been called the parallel parables. Some people have suggested that these parables originate precisely because of the new situation of early Christianity, of having both male and females equally in the catechetical community. And supposedly, although there's been some questioning of this, but supposedly in the normative synagogue pattern, only men study with the rabbi. Certainly we know in Christianity, women and men both studied and were prepared for baptism through study. There's also very likely that women in some occasions were included in the teaching ministry as well. So that the parallel parables perhaps try to get at that recognition that one has men and women. But there are other interesting aspects of them which I find striking. First of all, the images are parallel in the sense that Christ is the good shepherd seeking the lost sheep, and Christ is the old woman seeking the lost coin are parallel. They're not a hierarchical relationship. I mean, the old woman is not sort of helping the shepherd or something, but they're parallel figures. And it's in the parable of the old woman with the coin that the analogy is explicitly drawn to God. In other words, it's said that she is like God. because when she finds the coin, she throws a party and invites her friends. And in just such a way will God throw a party with the angels when one sinner who has lost has been found. By the way, when the Inclusive Language Lectionary Committee was meeting, particularly in doing the second and third year of the readings, they began to go beyond simply trying to find inclusive language and started asking about the selection of texts. And what they found is that very typically in the lectionary model that they were using, the male parable was there, but the female parallel parable was not. So that one of the things they sort of added back in was the female parallel parable. So one point I want to make about is the parallelness of the images. A second interesting point is that you have a shepherd and a housewife. You have a farmer sowing a seed and a woman sowing yeast and bread. You might say a farmer and a baker woman, but they are not sort of related to children or husbands or parents or anything of that kind, but rather the point of the parallelism is not their familial status. In other words, they're not talked about as mothers and fathers. The point of the parallelism is their work. In other words, that what is like God is that they are engaged in transforming work or seeking what is lost. And so that's the point of the, the metaphor is not God is like a baker woman, but the metaphor is God is like a baker woman doing this thing, sowing yeast, folding yeast into bread and from a small thing making a great thing rise and so on. So it's the point of the transforming work or the seeking. It's the activity that is the point of the metaphor. And then thirdly, I find interesting the fact that these images are drawn from basically Galilean peasants and not from the language of courts and kings and queens and royalty and so on, from which so much fell. Now there are, of course, other parables that do use king and steward and so on. So certainly there's a plurality of language used in the parables. But I think this particular group of parables is very interesting. And then one, of course, can talk about remnants of a kind of wisdom tradition in the Gospels as well, which in the Hebrew tradition had imaged the presence of God after a female personification of wisdom. And there are various ways to talk about either Jesus as the expression of divine wisdom or divine wisdom as like the Holy Spirit in relationship to Jesus and so on. And all of that, I think, helps to kind of break down the literalism of taking father-son language literally. If you have to think that which comes forth from God is wisdom as much as word, and wisdom in the scriptural tradition is in female personification, then I think you have to stop sort of taking what is basically metaphor as somehow literal, son, father kind of language. The early Syriac tradition in Christianity, roughly 1st, 2nd, 3rd century, particularly picked up on that female imagery for God's presence as wisdom, and tended to think of the Holy Spirit in female terms, and particularly tended to image the femaleness of the Holy Spirit in terms of language that relates to baptism. In other words, baptism is in effect the baptism of Father is seen as a womb, and the waters are the waters of rebirth, and so the Spirit is seen as the power of life in the womb of the waters of rebirth, and so on. So there's a whole kind of female imagery that's related to baptism. And it's also related to the whole language of the Christian initiate as a child fed with milk. And again, the whole, you might say, milk becomes tied in with the whole kind of nurturing imagery, and one has Syriac poetry that talks about the spirit as the filled breasts of God. So I'm just trying to indicate that early Christianity had a lot more fluidity of gender imagery than we have tended to realize or inherit in more recent terms. Okay, maybe we just stop a minute and see if we've got some particular questions about that.
When do you think we'll agree on a name? Like Abba or I Am or what?
Well, I guess what I'm trying to say is that we don't need to agree on a name.
Well, yes, but in a worship service.
And well, yeah.
Granted, we can do like Carol does, and we use different words. But for a corporate worship, sometimes wouldn't it be more helpful to have everybody using the same?
No, I'm not saying that at any one prayer. Everybody's shouting out six different names, but I'm saying within one worship service, one can use various names, metaphors, and so on, and that's really more helpful to help people to, first of all, to connect with a variety of ways of experiencing God,
mm-hmm.
And also to get over the idea that there is just one sort of master name that really is God, you know. And that's why I think that in any prayer service you can, and in fact should, use different metaphors. You can say at certain points, God who is mother and father. You can use other, you know, variety of things. And I think that's more creative. And that some of the objections to finding one sort of simple abstract name has tended to be that people then go to some rather cold, non-experiential name, like sovereign, 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 and you think, oh, God, if I hear one more sovereign, I'm going to run away, you know? Which, you know, I think it's, again, a lack of understanding of religious language is poetic rather than abstract, scientific, you know, which I think it's the scientific mentality that says there is one scientific term that corresponds to this reality.
If I could make an observation.
Yeah?
This year I was teaching in seventh grade confirmation. And in relation to what you said so far, I thought there were two points where there might be a need to particularly address the girls in the group. One was on the image of God. And it turns out the 12 and 13 year old I had no difficulty at all with any of the things you said in terms of an expanded image.
Uh-huh.
Was not restricted to father. It was something, in fact, that had not occurred to them in particular. The second thing was in relation to their position in church, and they did not at all feel that they were in any way subservient to the men. So one thing I think is really important in thinking about language is that these are dynamics, and they have a context that changes generation to generation.
Yeah.
And I think we ought not to dwell so long on getting the cobwebs out of our brains from the ways in which we were brought up, but address the future. And many of these problems are disappearing, it seems to me, from talking to children.
Well, I guess if one doesn't respond to where they are and keep using the old language, you're also, in effect, trying to re-socialize people back into the old reality, too, is what I'm saying. And if these were just 12-year-old girls...
Yeah,
because I mean, I wonder. So, I mean, I've certainly had other people who've talked about saying this to classes of boys and girls, and the boys will be very insistent that God is male, and see that very clearly as some reflection of their status.
Mm-hmm.
And so, shall we say, a little argument breaks out between the girls and the boys.
Yeah. I didn't have a problem.
Yeah, and that. So I mean, I think that we have a shifting social reality, but let me just say that I think a lot of our public images are partly out of step with the actual reality of the way people parent men and women and professional roles and so on, but they also function to set up a kind of norm that even if women are holding jobs and father helps clean the house as well as mother, that somehow the public norms that say fathers don't do that give children the idea that it's really there's something wrong with their family. You know, in other words, and this has been studied in terms of television imagery, for example. Did you have something?
Well, I was just going to provide a contrasting perspective. The other day on the hiking trail, our three-year-old son insisted God is he. And he said, well, Mary can be she. I don't know how he got the God and Mary kind of thing already at the age of three. And he said, well, if God can be he or she, then can Mary be he or she? So, I mean, our son already was so locked into God as he, and I don't know where he's gotten it.
Yeah.
Emphasizes the need to clean it up.
Yeah?
That's what the hero
is. You know, like God and seeing other images. But I really felt kind of strange, or maybe at the end of one time when we were hearing a sermon and Jesus was referred to as sheep. I just really, that upset me because I felt here was a real human being that.
Yeah, I wouldn't do that because, I mean, I think it's important to say human beings come in one gender or another, and Jesus happened to be a male, but his maleness does not establish the normativeness of maleness, nor does it establish that which is revealed of God in him is male. Mm-hmm. So I think those are the things to distinguish.
I suppose the young man kind of thing came in, but, you know, just to completely...
Yeah, see, I really, that would be a place where I would really question, you know, I would object to that. And I'm not terribly entranced by the Jungian, you know, we're all male and female, or we're all masculine and feminine. I think that comes from a culture that has split males into masculine and feminine. And then in order to have a language for us being whole persons, you have to say, well, we're both masculine and feminine. And what we should really say is we're both whole human beings as males or females. So I think the language keeps sort of importing back a kind of stereotype that if you nurture, you're feminine. And needless to say, in our language, that gets linked with all kinds of rather slightly negative images for males, otherwise known as effeminate, etc. So, I mean, I think we need a different language that says we're whole persons as males and females, and that nurturing is as much a quality of male personhood as it is a female personhood. Let me just kind of do my little shtick here on divine parenthood, and then we'll go on with the next phase here. Basically, I want to ask some questions about both the usefulness and the limits of thinking of God as parent. I would say that there's a usefulness to it. There are many ways in which parenting is an important image for God. Shall we say more as an ideal than what most of us have experienced as actual parents. Sort of a hard act to follow, shall we say, for real parents. But I think there's several things that make the analogy appropriate, the notion of God as the source of our being, the whole creator image, and our immediate experience of those who are sources of our being, our parents. Obviously a whole sense of those people who established the context in which we felt loved, trusted, able to grow, and yet always know that we are accepted. All of those kind of things, I think, establish parenting as a positive image, an appropriate image for God. But I think it's also a limited image. And so I think there's some problems with using parent as the only image. In other words, what I'd like to say is I think we've overdone it. And by a kind of overuse of the parent-child metaphor as the only or virtually the exclusive metaphor, I think it tends to suggest what I would call neurotic parenting rather than good parenting. I remember a good friend, Gregory Baum, years ago, said that we have imaged God after a neurotic parent. Now, what's a neurotic parent? I think a neurotic parent, whether mother or father, is a parent that doesn't want to let go of their children, that isn't able to nurture children toward autonomous adulthood, but wants them to remain dependent, wants them to remain under their authority. You know, that can't really accept the children growing up and getting out from under their control. And I think a lot of our language for God as parent has a lot of those kind of neurotic parenting qualities to it. That suggests that God really doesn't want you to grow up, and then becoming an autonomous adult is really something that makes God extremely annoyed. I mean, in fact, it's at some point, if you look carefully at the language, for example, about the Garden of Eden and what the fall was all about, if you kind of unpack that and apply it to parents, you come pretty close to saying the growing up is sin. And that we remain sort of good and loved by God if we sort of keep this little space in ourselves, which really never becomes a responsible adult that takes responsibility for what we believe, for what we think, for what our own values are, and is always kind of related to parenting figures as the ones that know everything, and we don't know anything, and we have to go to them to know anything. And so I think that this also corresponds in modern Christianity to what I see between a split between religious and secular life. That we have tended to create a kind of dichotomy in which people who become adults, they become adults by becoming secular people, and the secular world is where you become autonomous. But if you want to remain religious, you keep this little part of yourself that is always as a little child. And so the infantile part of yourself, the part that doesn't grow up and take responsibility, is the part that is your religious self. One of my best stories about that is a story about Martin Marty. I don't know whether apocryphal or not, because I heard it secondhand. Not from him, but in any ways, it seems to me to sort of encapsulate the way in which we use religion as our little place of infantilization. And according to this story, Martin Marty got on a plane, as I'm sure he does many times, and he sat down next to a man who was in astrophysics, and they got to talking, and the man asked Marty what he does, and he says, "Well, I'm a theologian." The other guy says, "Well, I'm astrophysicist," and so on. The man says, "Well, you know, I'm a Christian, and for me, it's enough to say that Jesus loves me. This I know. In other words, I don't need any theology. You know, if to be a good Christian, all I need to know is that Jesus loves me. This I know." And Marty said, "Well, for me, in terms of astrophysics, it's enough to know, twinkle, twinkle, little star." So to me, that's a kind of beautiful story in terms of the way religion is where even enormously sophisticated scientific people can think it's quite all right to be kind of a pre-kindergarten level person. And if you look at certain aspects of our religious culture and so on, I think you'll see some of that aspect. So I think there's a whole kind of problem in making the religious part of yourself the part that never grows up.
Excuse me, I was just going to say, we had a friend who we used to get together maybe once a year, and my husband would, you know, try to feel him out theologically, and he said, "I don't want to worry about that part of my life." He said, "Let the priest or whoever worry about it," but he said, "I've got other worries in my business life and my social life." He said,
"Yeah, exactly.
Leave that to the other," you know, and it was just very naive as far as childlike.
Yeah, that you really don't want to have to take responsibility for this part. You know, that's what we pay you for, ministers. And so, and I think that also relates to people becoming quite hostile when one brings in real, you know, ethical problems into worship, because that's in some way worship for many people is where they sort of escape from reality, and they certainly don't want to hear about, you know, Gulf oil and stuff like that. So I'm suggesting that one needs to model God. First of all, the parenting is one image, and it needs to be, shall we say, balanced by other kinds of images of relationship, such as liberator, teacher, friend, and so on, that are the relationships that are connected more with becoming adult people. But I think also, if one is going to keep parenting as one image for God, one has to image God as parent after what I would call good parenting rather than neurotic parenting. And what I mean by good parenting is a couple of things. First of all, the parents come in both genders. and so if God is parent, then God is mother and father and not just father. And secondly, that if one thinks of God as parent, mother and father, then one needs to think of that parenting not simply after a kind of dualistic mothering and fathering, in which sort of authority without nurture is assigned to fathers and nurture without authority is assigned to mothers. Whereas I would suggest that we need a co-parenting, which is of course based on a partnership relationship of men and women who are helping each other to grow into full personhood, and then who parent children as partners rather than as sort of stereotypic opposites. So a co-parenting, I think, assumes that both men and women are cooperatively parenting, and they're parenting as full people in partnership and not sort of stereotypic opposites. And then finally, of course, the parenting has to do with a kind of good combination of nurture, discipline, love, authority, and as well as the kind of process that helps people stage by stage grow up. And the ultimate goal of this is indeed to become an autonomous adult, a person who takes responsibility for their own life. And so part of good parenting is knowing the appropriate places to let go and let your children make mistakes and become adults. And then my final point I want to make is that it's very important not to let go of the father side of parenting. It was when you think of the present emphasis in certain feminist circles, particularly some of the post-Christian groups, that really want to sort of abolish God the Father for the mother goddess. And that sort of thought as the ultimate feminist thing, to have a mother goddess rather than God the Father. And I would suggest that falls all too readily into, in fact, precisely the modern pattern. Far from being a Stone Age model, it is, in fact, an all too modern tendency to make women not only primary parents, but sole parents. and precisely to marginalize men as fathers. Diane Tennis, who is a Presbyterian feminist writer, works for the Presbyterian bureaucracy, and happens to be a single mother, has written, I think, a very strong book that called Is God the Only Reliable Father? And basically what she's arguing is precisely that we must not let go of the father side of the image of God as parent, since that will indeed fall all too readily into a pattern that makes women sole, not only primary but practically sole parents, and allows men to think that this is really not anything particularly important. So I think that's part of the reason I'm not so hot on simply mother goddess. It always made me nervous. I'm increasingly aware of why. it makes me nervous. So I would suggest the kind of image that if we're going to unpack the idea of God as parent, one needs to be able to integrate fatherhood, but fatherhood as as not just sort of distant and domineering, but the fatherhood that has integrated nurture and discipline, as well as a motherhood that integrates nurture and discipline, and have a kind of strong sense of God as mother and father in that partnership, you know, helping you grow up model rather than certainly assigning all parenting to women in a mother goddess model, or construing fatherhood only in terms of sort of distant, wrathful, and domineering models, which in fact I suspect very few of us have actually experienced. But I doubt very much that most of us have actually experienced. Some of you may have. I mean, certainly my own experience was that of growing up with a father who was distant, primarily because he was away at the war most of the time, and mother as the primary parent, who was much more the combination of disciplinarian and nurturer. And when father was home, he was much more the kind of uncritical one who you had a good time with. When daddy came home, you know, you went out for hot fudge sundaes and something like that. You know, it's kind of an uncritical sort of nurturing, whereas all the real parenting was mothering. So I'm really suggesting a kind of interconnection here between thinking out good models of parenting and thinking out how God then becomes a way of urging us forward to good models of parenting. Any thoughts about that?
Yeah? I've been thinking about it all week, in a sense. I really like the balance. But what I was reflecting on, and I mean this in terms, is that it seemed to me that when I grew up, very often I would hear from different people, churches for women and children. And especially in the 30s and so forth, when I grew up as a little kid and so forth, I think people were coming out of the Depression and that, and had a lot of men had negative feelings about the church because it really didn't address where they were at as far as employment and everything else. And then I'm just reflecting also in the seminary and so forth, we often used to make critical kind of remarks about Solomon's head of Christ as the bearded lady. You know? And I'm just wrestling with that in terms of the images that men have had of Christ, and some of the turnoffs that they've had in relationship to gender.
Yeah, well, I mean, I would agree with you, and I think that reflects part of what I'm trying to say,
yeah,
about the neurotic parenting,
right,
which then suggests that the good Christian stays dependent, docile, and so on, which is precisely the stereotypic women and children,
yeah,
that don't grow up, that stay dependent, and so on. And so your average adult male felt, particularly as layman, felt demeaned. And that's not just in recent Protestantism. That's classic in practically all Latin Catholicism, where the men don't even come to church. I mean, basically by 12, the men stand around and talk outside the church. Women and children and old people go to church. And I think that reflects that sense of an all-male priesthood as an authority, but which then reduces laity to this relationship of dependency. And as you start integrating both men and women into the ministry and start integrating more inclusive images of God, what I'd like to suggest is that there are two ways we could go with that. And a lot of the current tendencies goes in a direction that I think is very bad, which is to say to further feminize religion. Feminize in the sense of thinking of it as the little place of where all is sweet and good, and there's butterflies, balloons, flowers, kittens, and puppies. There's not even adult animals, much less adult people. And I remember seeing an inclusive language hymnal done by a very well-meaning Methodist, a couple, you know, who had very good ideas of co-parenting and so on. And yet I was scandalized by the fact that all of the images were sort of the kindergarten level. And you hadn't a single image of an adult human being in the whole thing. So I think we should beware of mother goddesses and happy children, kittens, flowers, butterflies. and as we start integrating women into clergy and, you know, into images of God, that we move that toward somehow responsible adulthood of men and women rather than further infantilization. Yeah?
This is some sort of reflections and comments and questions. I'm not quite sure what I mean. I was very taken with, as I was rereading Beyond God the Father and actually knowing you in terms of myself being very careful of no longer even using the term androgyny or masculine and feminine. And a sense from you that each human person, no matter what gender, can come to full humanhood. And Mary Daly in her book Beyond God the Father talks about the potential for psychic unity of each individual person of either gender. Then following through on that, if within me, myself, I have the full potential of humanhood, although I do it as a woman, and I do have some contact with women who are single parents, either through battering or whatever, or lesbians, and who are primarily communities of women. And I sort of move in and out of these communities and have been involved in some of goddess reading. And I think it is at least potentially possible if we take the understanding of full human as being within each person of either gender, that it is possible anyway for the goddess to have those images of fullness. And not necessarily that it always happens that way. But there are communities that I think I have a very healthy imaging forth of the multiplicity of images of God, and they put the term goddess on that. So.
Yeah. Oh well. Yeah, I think that's a whole other question. Let me first say that although I think we all have as men and women the capacity for full humanhood, and I'd like to get beyond stereotyping certain psychic capacities of masculine and others feminine. I think that there is kind of dialectic in ourselves, left and right brain and so on, but that we need to stop giving those sort of these gender names, which I think are confusing. But I also don't think that we get to that full personhood in isolation. it is in community. And this community takes sometimes the form of one person caring for the other, and sometimes the other caring for the other. You know, a whole multiplicity of relationships, multi-sided relationships. And I think traditional complementarity basically sets up relationships in which one person specializes in one kind of relationship, one with the other. Is what I call like my parents-in-law, in which one was blind and one was deaf, and they were very interdependent, but they didn't communicate very well. Because they had, you know, practically nothing in common. So I think that we've set up those kind of things, and I think we need a much more complex sense of partnership as community, which helps us each to grow in relationship to our full potential. I think that's possible in communities of men or communities of women. The world does happen to exist in two genders, and although there are occasional communities of only men or only women, it seems to be much more typically, even those women are going to have to deal with some relationships with men. I don't think anybody lives on some other planet, you know. So it seems to be a whole kind of interaction between those two major types of human beings that do exist, namely men and women. Is very basic to developing into one's full potential, and that doesn't mean that men just have these one set of capacities, women another, but that seems to me that's just kind of just like we need to live on the planet with people of many cultures, we need to live on the planet, and usually in the same household, with people of both genders. So, I mean, I think there can be healthy relationships that are primary women. But I would suspect that those are healthy partly to the extent that they also are able to have friendships with men as well. Because I do think there's something unhealthy with feeling that there's that the whole other half of the human race is people you can't relate to. Just, I mean, to be in the same way if you feel that somebody of any other race is of people you can't relate to. And perhaps more basic gender is than race in that regard. So, I mean, the let's say healthy lesbians I know are also women that have good friendships with men. So I would really I can understand periods of separatism in terms of woundedness and healing. But it seems to me that one doesn't get to healthy personhood unless you're able to deal with this rather, you know, major group of other people, maybe people of the other gender. Yeah.
I wanted to go back to the comments a few minutes ago about the Jewish feminized church kind of stereotype, etc. Because I think that very much carries over at some irrational kinds of levels in terms of people's response towards clergy women.
Yeah.
And I think, therefore, it's what's important is to have some empirical evidence to counter that. For example, in 78, when I left the congregation that I had pastored for 4 years, I did a little statistical study of what the percentage of male and female members of that church was like after I left, and I discovered the male membership had increased by at least 15%. Now this was, you know, a congregation of 150, so it wasn't, you know, big numbers we were dealing with. It isn't that we had
7.5.
You know, but nevertheless, and I think that has in a number of cases been demonstrated to be the case, you know, which I think says, you know, a lot about, you know, whatever sexual dynamics or whatever have been there all along when the clergy have been primarily male, etc. But, you know, so I think whenever that fear pops up of, well, gee, if we ordain women, then men will certainly continue leading the church, you know, is something that we really have to counter, because that's not the case.
Yeah.
You know, maybe some cases, yeah, where some men have chose to lead, and those then get, you know, really raised up high as what's happening all over the place, but I don't think that's the case, and therefore I think that interpretation just carries over and just,
yeah,
adds fuel to the fire.
And I think it's important to do the kind of sociological study of Christianity that makes it clear that men coming in lesser numbers than women to the church has been endemic to the church before. It has nothing, and that's very closely related to a paternalistic model of clericalism that treats the laity as children, and it's that pattern which drives adult males out of the church, and that to the extent to which one has male clergy that treats you like adults, and males and females in the clergy that can create a sense that also relate to the laity as co-ministry, that you're going to have the dynamics of healthy ministry, as far as I'm concerned. So that in some ways an integrated clergy ought to be moving in the other direction from infantilization, yeah?
My husband has been in co-ministry with a woman, and he has found as time goes on that he's had to start a men's group.
Uh-huh.
So that men get their feelings out, maybe first their anger, and then finding out who they are, and then maybe eventually integrate back into a combined group. But at the moment, he's had to have this happen. There's a great need for them to really air their feelings, and then really to study just where can I cry or things like that. And as a man, can I do these things?
Yeah, by the way, I've been told to announce that there is a men's group that has been formed. Holy Village, and it's meeting for the first time at 2 this afternoon. And I certainly would endorse it. To me, feminism, and maybe one needs eventually even to go beyond the word feminism to some other word like holism, has to do with liberating men and women from patriarchal and truncated kinds of humanity that have been created by certain kinds of gender stereotypes. And that there's something increasingly problematic about feminism being something that only women do, in the sense that women, in effect, are going further and further in sort of analyzing and consciousness raising and so on. And that I think one very much needs a parallel movement of men figuring out what's happened to them under patriarchy. And I think it's very hard. The typical thing seems to me is that it's hard for men to talk to each other about this.
Right.
Because the men that I know that they're interested in this tend to want to come and talk to women, and so they become very hurt when women's groups say, we want a man in here, you know. But what tends to be hard is for men to say, well, let's get some men together to talk about this, and then come together at some new space.
They've gotten together to recreation-wise, or they've gotten together to fish or something like that.
Yeah,
not,
I mean,
to share feelings.
Yeah, I think, I mean, there is a whole kind of culture of male bonding, but it has, men will have to analyze the culture of male bonding, but I suspect it tends to keep itself within certain kinds of limits and not to be a place where you can talk about feelings and vulnerability and so on. Yeah?
I'd like to go back to a developmental question. A 3-year-old who sees down the image of his father, and I mentioned some 12-year-olds, supposedly these are all on a trajectory of becoming full people at some point. If you have multiple metaphors for God, then is it not likely that there are some of those that are more appropriate at certain stages of development than others? And if so, then what should we start using as metaphors for God for the youngest children?
How about mama, dada?
But both. But see, here we had a case, I guess, where a 3-year-old has seized on father as being the stronger.
Sure.
Misperceiving this particular family, from what I
hear. I guess what I'm saying is the influence. I think what we tend to discount is how quickly the rest of society intervenes, and we have this illusion that somehow the parents are giving this kid his whole culture, but this kid is watching television.
This kid has male genitals like this kid's father.
Also, his friends being people connected with the seminary, more conscious of this, and yet, you know, even
yeah.
in a community like that.
And so you find very quickly that even very small children are saying, well, I know that daddy helps clean the house and mommy has a job, but that's not the way it should be. You should be home making cookies, you know, and so on.
So maybe God language at that age does need to be scrupulously neutral.
Well, I guess I'm inclined to
interpret that in a broader context.